You're a SaaS founder. You've built something solid, but growth still feels harder than it should. Most SaaS companies don't fail because of bad tech. They fail because they've never become a must-have to the right customer. This podcast is here to change that. I'm Ton Dobbe, and this is the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. Every week, I talk to founders in the trenches, facing friction, making bold moves, and building companies that last. We dig into real choices around focus, positioning, customer pool, team alignment, the things that separate forgettable software from the ones that people can't live without. No hype, no hacks, just honest conversations to help you build something that people would miss if it was gone. If your SaaS should be indispensable but isn't yet, this is your podcast. Let's get into it. The guest on my podcast this week is Sid Mason, CEO and co-founder of Wokalo.
Capital efficiency for us, being slightly constrained at times, actually helps us in being more innovative, right? The most innovations, the most disruptive ideas actually come out of like constraints. And we don't want to give our team or, you know, even us as founders that luxury that, hey, there's enough, money on the table that I can go and do a land grab. I think we need to still solve a few fundamentals.
This is Sid. We dig into why he prioritized accuracy over speed, where every competitor was doing the opposite. Early customers pushed back on the 20 to 30 minutes wait time, and he used that friction to identify who valued being right over being fast. You'll hear how they learned which segments truly value depth over speed, why usage alone doesn't predict retention, and what happens when you triangulate usage with perceived value. The conversation reveals why saying no to attractive customers can be the most important growth decision, and what changes when you stop chasing every dollar on the table. Well, hi, Sid. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, well, there's this whole wave of agentic AI and, there was this wave of generative, and then they'll move towards agents. And I saw that you were one of the first to start experimenting with this when it was not a thing yet. So that intrigued me. But then I started reading your story, and I found it intriguing in the first place about how you started it and also what you stand for. So I had to have you on the podcast, Remarkable things happen there. So before we start talking about your company, Wokalo, what drives you? What does give you energy as an entrepreneur?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, right? Like, I didn't choose entrepreneurship like that. I had to do it. It happened very organically. But what really drives me is, making some change, transformative change that can impact a lot of people. You could do that professionally in your job. You can do that as an entrepreneur. As an entrepreneur, of course, it gives you that ability to do it at a different scale and just reimagine things. But I think just transforming lives and a lot of them having that scaled impact is something that drives me. And it's always a journey, right? Because that scale might be very relative from, where you are working in which domain. But I think, as long as that journey translates into a meaningful change for your stakeholders, for your customers, for your employees, I think that's something that drives me.
Yeah, exactly. You couldn't have said it better. This is what it's really all about. And I like also the way you talk about it, because you take it from the customer perspective. To help create impact for them that is, from something where they are to something where it's a better place. So that makes a nice bridge to your company, which you started in 2022, I saw, together with your co-founder. What is the big idea behind this company? Like, what was the problem that you saw or experienced where you thought, hey, something needs to change here?
Yeah, sure. So in terms of my background on, I started my career as a management consultant. And most of my life as a consultant, I did a lot of like private equity, due diligence, growth strategies, building those PowerPoint decks, doing a lot of research at any given point in time, having 20, 30 tabs open of different websites, subscriptions out there, just to do solid research for many of our consulting projects, right? Very time consuming. a lot of grunt work involved, very intellectually stimulating at the same time. Sometimes you also get tired reading through those hundreds of articles. But I think in all of those consulting projects, which are time bound, it could be 4 week to 2 to 3 months, depending on the type of project. You always leave that project with I mean, at least for me, it was like I'm always leaving some insights on the table. You could always do some more analysis, with a short, small team size. You cannot read through all the data that's out there. So you always felt like, hey, I could do more. So, a lot of that grunt work, a lot of those midnight hours pulling, creating those PowerPoint decks, to always having that lingering feeling of that, hey, I could have done more in terms of, doing some additional analysis. That's really the problem that I faced, but several other consultants, researchers, analysts do in the financial services space. And that's really the reason why we started Book Hello, right? Like as I said earlier, I never thought of, being an entrepreneur, but, while I was trying to upskill myself, I had my first degree as an engineer, then an MBA, the cliched way of, learning, and I grew up in India. But when I came to the States and did a lot of consulting, I realized that a lot of my aspirations were on the product technical side of things. And that's why I thought I'll do my second master's in AI. Was fortunate that this is really the time in generative AI was just getting started. So I got my hands on, GPT-1, 2 beta versions back in the day. And it became very evident just looking at those very initial raw versions that this is going to be a transformative tech. Once in a generation for sure. Directionally, it had the right kind of indicators, and built out a prototype and thought that, hey, this could really change the way a lot of the desk research, heavy unstructured data analysis is done. And it could really not just change consulting, but larger professional services. And we're seeing those impacts not just in finance, in consulting, but even legal and in so much more. So I think that's really where the idea came from, and genuine problem that we both co-founders faced ourselves.
Makes total sense. And gosh, what has changed since that time frame? I mean, we're talking about it like a time frame of 3 years, and it almost feels like a decade.
It does.
That's probably also, what makes it so hard to create something that creates a moat, right? So going back to that point, you started, like you say, did an extra MBA in AI, and started working with some beta versions of things, and you started building your prototypes. What has been an early decision that appeared to be really important for where you are today?
Yeah, I think when we started building out Book Hello, this is almost a year before ChatGPT even came out, right? There was no concept as RAG. There was no concept as agents. We had seen some earlier versions of what people call as wrappers. I don't like to use that term because wrapper can be valuable, although we, of course, are a full stack platform in that sense, and I'll come to that in a bit. But what we saw was many of the tools taking up approach where it's a very question and answer based interface, just like ChatGPT is today. You ask a question, you get responses, you can ask some follow-ups. And we thought it was good for a lot of your horizontal use cases, maybe for writing an email or writing a blog or copywriting. But when it comes to more high accuracy, fidelity, use cases, especially for financial services, we thought that is probably not the right approach. To get instant answers, right? Because if you want to get instant answers, you're relying on the underlying knowledge base of these large language models, which is unfortunately trained on some great data, but also a lot of like junk data, right? So that's why you come across these hallucinations and problems like that. So we thought many of our customers want instant gratification, they want instant answers, but we took a very contrarian approach. We said that, hey, you know what? Book Hello is going to be a workflow automation tool. It's not going to be an instant answer, question answer engine. What that meant was anytime you want to get some analysis or a report out of Book Hello, it takes about 20 to 30 minutes. And that's a long time. People are used to getting immediate responses on a ChatGPT, right? And we stuck to that approach. And we got a lot of like negative feedback from our customers that, hey, why is this taking so long? We've stuck to that.
Well, it usually took 3 days or more.
Yeah, it took 3 days. I mean, I used to take weeks to do that same amount of work. You're not lifting your own fingers. AI or the machine is kind of doing that job in like 30 minutes, rather than doing it like an instant answer. And I tell my clients, and some of them have become have changed, become believers that good things in life take some time. And honestly, 20, 30 minutes is not a lot, but those 20, 30 minutes give us a lot of avenues for improving that accuracy, having those fact checks in place, ensuring that the best sources are being prioritized. We do everything real time, not using any stale data. So, because it's a live agent, it gives you that level of fidelity that we expect in this space. But that decision was very pivotal from a product positioning standpoint, from an architecture standpoint, from a user interface standpoint. So, a very contrarian decision. And when we see most of our competitors or peers, we see them taking the very same approach of a Q&A interface. But I think this has served us well. And I think that has been one of the most pivotal, may seem tactical decision, but it's a very strategic decision for us, which seemed contrary.
I love that because everybody, I mean, you do the expected and you just follow that, that desire to have things in 30 seconds. You take these inaccuracies for granted almost. And but that is fine for maybe half the world or possibly more. But in certain use cases, it's an it's an absolute no-no. So this decision to go and take the workflow approach, the contrarian thing that, okay, it's going to take time because it needs to be accurate. How has it also influenced who you're building this for? Because you said research, but any specific research? Do you see that, for example, in one industry, there's this problem is bigger than in other industries?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we serve different set of like segments, right from private equity, venture capital to investment banking, consulting firms, all over. And the needs, the pain points, the use cases are different for each one of these, although the underlying tech stack might be very similar in terms of the data engineering, in terms of the interface. We see that venture capital is like more high volume, quick responses, quick glancing, would not have the data to go into that depth. So of course, they want something much sooner, faster. Whereas on the other side of the spectrum, we see consulting firms really go very deep, add a lot of rigor because that's what they're getting paid for, right? So I think those aspirations, those needs are very different from these two segments. And again, within the same customer persona, there might be different use cases, right? For example, in investment banking, if a banker wants to get a quick insight on what are the key insights from the last, earnings call, they would want it instantaneously. But if they want a very deep analysis on a biotech company in terms of what R&D and, intellectual property that they're kind of building, they're okay to wait for some time. So we're seeing these variations of expectations across different segments of customers. VC being very instant gratification oriented, consulting being patient and detail oriented. But even within the same segments, we see multiple users. A senior partner in a consulting firm or investment bank will want something in like 10, 15 minutes at max. But a junior analyst doesn't mind waiting for longer because they are the ones who are getting into the weeds. So that's what we're observing the market right now.
Yeah, completely agree. And the question at the end is, of course, which of those use cases and what type of settings and scenarios your product fits best. Now, talking about, you started 2022, it's now 2025. ChatGPT was not on the market. It is today. There's version 5 already. All of these vendors are incorporating the research features almost for free. So, what are you doing different in this case, not only from a contrarian perspective, but also to keep staying ahead of the market?
So every time a new release of OpenAI, ChatGPT, or GPT-5 now and future versions come in, but even other vendors like very, very good to see the progress that Anthropic and Gemini have also made in the recent past. We honestly welcome every time those models improve because that further elevates our platform's own value creation opportunities. The way a vertical AI platform is slightly different from horizontal use cases. I do think that certain horizontal use cases are definitely more likely to be disrupted by the foundation models as they kind of progress and get better. We saw it in copywriting, right? We're seeing it in email generation, those kind of use cases. But certain horizontal applications like a CRM is still very specialized. But you know, extend that to even a vertical AI application. We feel that wherever there is a high degree of domain expertise involved, that's where your underlying horizontal
True.
models can just be very generic, be it legal, be it healthcare, be it financial services. So that's at a, you know, a design philosophy level where we strongly believe that domain results in a lot of specialization, which cannot be done with that degree of fidelity in a horizontal foundation model.
Yeah, true.
But if you look at it in terms of, you know, what we are doing is we basically have the liberty to have a different user experience or an interaction design for every different workflow, right? A generic horizontal platform, you can still ask questions, get responses back, and fine-tune them. But you know, some of our workflows are very grid view oriented, right? I want to see a list of companies. I want to see XYZ columns in it. I want the ability to select all or select some of them and generate a report for multiple. Those interactions and that luxury is not something you know, a foundation model can provide, but they are very important from an end user perspective. You know, extending that analogy to, you know, another use case is, let's say we want to have plugins in Word and PowerPoint, or I want to have exports in PowerPoint, a slide creation, just like a McKinsey or a Bain consultant would do. Can we get that same level of fidelity into a platform? So not only are we pulling in our own proprietary data that we source ourselves, we also license data from third parties, the likes of S&P, CapIQ, Crunchbase, PitchBooks of the world. But beyond just the data, there is a lot of those use cases that have to be blended in. Now, where we are different is because we have to ensure there's that, you know, guardrails. There is zero hallucination incidents. So, you know, there's a massive amount of data engineering. Our average deep research report has about 6,500 prompts pre-configured. A generic deep research from an OpenAI might just have 20, 30 odd sub prompts, if you may. So the density, the fidelity, the accuracy, the white glove support that we provide, the integrations that we provide, all add together in terms of a very different user experience and an outcome which is far more differentiated, right? And that's why when the underlying models get better, we're able to do, you know, even better job. But those end workflows are very different of how they might look for a horizontal tool out there.
Yeah, strong point. Yeah, I mean it proves again that the moment you go, you might have a horizontal use case that everybody that needs to do research can use. The moment you go vertical, that's where you, like you say, that's where you can be differentiated. That's where you can
That's
solve
right.
a particular high value and a critical problem for a company in a much better way, and you become the only choice. Because likely you have competitors, but there are situations where you are the only one.
That's right. That's right. And just to clarify, right? Like when we say we're a vertical AI platform, there is still a world where there might be certain segments of our users who can still use the horizontal tools and be happy with it. Let's say I'm a solo GP in a venture capital fund. I get 50, 60% of the output quality of Okello using an OpenAI deep research, but I need to pay a much lesser. I'm happy with that. That's perfectly fine. But then there are those institutional firms, those larger enterprises or mid-market firms as well, for whom that additional quality jump, that additional accuracy, that additional insight really moves the needle for them, and they're willing to pay. So, you know, that's another kind of lens to keep in mind of, you know, which segment are you appealing for?
It's like I'm an open book on that. It's for me, it's always okay. Create a product that whereby you become the only choice for a customer, and that, yeah, where people happily pay a premium. Because when you do something like that, that is not a race to the bottom anymore. There's place for everybody, but it requires also to be able to say, hey, okay, some parts of the markets are not for me. That's fine.
That's been a journey for us. And, you know, I totally resonate with the thought, right? You can't make things for everyone. As a startup, you know, this is my first startup as such, right? So a lot of learnings over there. We tried to be everything for everyone initially, like whoever is going to buy it, like, yeah, let's just sell, you know, dollars on the table. Who doesn't want that? But I think we had that realization, Tom, to your point, that you can't build it for everyone. And that's why we had to take a few hard decisions that there are a few segments that we want to deprioritize where even if the customers might be initially buying it, but we're not the right platform for them. We can't go very deep. For us, customizations and the configurability is very important, right? Because when we talk to enterprises, they have their own secret sauce. They have their own methodologies and frameworks. When they use these horizontal tools, they're getting a very standard cookie cutter kind of a response, right? And it doesn't differentiate them because all of their peers are also on OpenAI enterprise subscription. So how do I differentiate? And that's where those customizations, configurability become really important to codify into the platform. And we can't do that for everyone out there. So we had to take a few hard decisions that, for smaller SMBs, we are probably not the right platform. There are other tools at a different price point that serve that segment much better.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it goes back to to trade number one in my book. It's trade one for the reason. Remarkable software companies realize that cannot please everybody. And that's about making those choices. So what was that exact moment where you said, okay, hey, enough is enough. Here's the focus. The rest is a no.
So interestingly, we were getting a lot of traction from a couple of these segments because they're more tech savvy, they're more amenable to kind of trying out different technologies, new technologies, quite enamored by it. It's easy to reach them through using digital, kind of channels. So getting those customers was not the biggest problem. However, what we realized is once we onboarded them, the level of aspirations, the changes, the requests that they would have would be probably more demanding than even an enterprise customer, which is fair. I mean, to all credit to them, and we loved working with them. And I think initially, as a company, you also want to work with certain players who may not give you a lot of dollars in terms of the upside, but at least the learnings that they give you is like really helpful.
Sure.
So we definitely waited and were patient, but at the same time, we realized that as the large language models keep on getting better and the price points keep coming down, there will be a point at which for them to pay a premium for our platform will not be justified. But even if they do, the level of effort that we need to provide in terms of supporting them will not be sustainable for our own business.
Yeah.
And that really was a tipping point for us to take that hard decision that whether this is a segment worth kind of doubling down on. So I think it was a more of a pragmatic business decision. In considering how the market is evolving, what are the different price points, what are their expectations, and sometimes it's all the more contrarian because it's easy to attract those customers, but eventually we thought that either we will not be able to service them really well, or we'll compromise on some of the big ticket whale accounts or elephant accounts, if you may,
Sure.
and then that's really where we took that call. So I think it was more of a pragmatic business call than anything
Of
else.
course, it always is. And you have to learn that the hard way. And everybody always thinks, okay, but we are niched down enough, and you're not. The fact that you say, okay, I'm niched down on banks, well, not every bank is going to be the same bank. And one
Exactly.
bank has the exact perfect use case, and the other banks have generic use cases. So, what typically I always talk about, we're not typically in the enterprise software space, we're not competing against, well, feature to feature, because that's what people see. You got this feature, you got that feature, and then therefore you likely can help me. But at the end, it's about your approach that you're taking to solve the problem. And where others take the fast approach and offer that at a very, very low price, at $20 a month, you solve it the other way around and you charge them, well, tenfold or more per month. Some people might think you're expensive, and other people think because you solved my problem so well, this is actually cheap. That's the choice to make. Good.
That's right.
Let me see. So many things to ask here. What I read is that you currently, well, you, of course, you focus on the enterprise. You also focus on private markets where the data is actually scarce rather than always available. How many customers do you currently have? 50, 60?
We have close to 50 now.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I started to calculate for myself. What have you learned from getting the first 10? What was hard to get that first traction and for you to see, hey, this is working, maybe this is working a little less?
Yeah, sure. The first 10 customers was a journey by itself. I think, first of all, a huge deal of respect to the first 10 buyers, right? Because they're buying into you as a founding team, you as a founder,
True.
you as an idea, because you don't really don't have something concrete in terms of showing that, hey, I'm serving maybe 30, hundreds of Fortune 100 companies, right? You don't have that credibility in the market. So they're actually investing in you. So I have a great deal of respect for our first-time customers. Early customers are always good fun because they give you a lot of feedback. They're invested in you because you don't come with that credibility or the track record. So the learnings for us was essentially, how is the adoption really taking place, right? Like one part of it is, having something, being able to make a sale. But more importantly, what we were tracking is, are we getting the right retention? Are we getting the right adoption? Are they actually finding value in it? And of course, you get both sides of it, some very pleased customers and some not so pleased customers. And all of this is like extremely valuable. What gave us the conviction to double down on a few segments was purely the usage that we saw, right? Among consulting firms, among investment banks, VCs, growth stage. The volume of usage kind of surprised us. And I think that was a very good indicator for us that, hey, we doubled down on these particular segments. At the same time, there were certain customers who did not like the platform, who did not find value. And those are even more valuable lessons for us, right, in terms of company building, in terms of product building. For example, there were a few integrations that we were supposed to support, right, which had the customer had an expectation. But it turns out they just did not have the data pipelines in place to persist their data into the platform, right? So very little that we could do. So that gave us a lot of those micro learnings, if you may, which is like, hey, if a customer has these XYZ tech stack, then it's more likely to probably have greater usage. If they are using another tool like a CRM, which can integrate with our platform, Vocalo, of course, the usage is going to spike because they don't have to come on the platform on their own. And, a lot of those things can run behind the scenes automated manner. So I think if we kind of zoom out of all of these learnings, I think if I were to synthesize it, usage reports, usage trends, their ability to coming back to the platform over and over again. So just usage in isolation is not going to help you. You're going to have spurts of growth, when people need something valuable. But I think a true test is the frequency. Are they coming back to the platform every week or every month or, whatever the frequency is set out. So that was one important lever for us. But I think a lot of the early customers provide you feedback is even beyond the usage. And I think that was a true learning for us. We thought there were certain customers who had very low usage would probably churn and they're not finding value on the platform. But it turns out just those very few reports that they would have run on the platform were so valuable to them that was surprising for us and they renewed, but they even expanded from an account expectation perspective. So that gave us that, learning and that insight that usage is one important proxy, but that alone is not sufficient. And that when triangulated with value, what is the perceived value by every customer that varies from person to person, from organization to organization. So even if you're seeing very high usage, and we've also had certain customers who whose usage was like up through the roofs, right? But they still churned after 3 months. So that again gave us that insight that, you need to triangulate usage along with the perceived value. But what is that perceived value? What are those outcomes that you're driving? So then we learned that, hey, our segmentation of which customer segments to double down should be actually measured in terms of what outcomes can you drive. Now, it's not very easy at
Always.
times to measure those outcomes from firm to firm, especially when you're dealing with like so many different personas. But I think that's really what our 10 first customers taught us.
Exactly. It's always about an outcome at the end. It's not what like the time that you're saving on certain things. It's the value that people can create, like you said before. It needs to differentiate them. Well, that's one of them. That's one of the arguments.
There's one gentleman who runs this is a sole proprietor, but has a small lean team of like three or four people. Did not expect him to be paying in thousands of dollars that we have as a price point, but he still bought it. And even then, I was slightly nervous. Will this person really use it? Their actual usage was very low, but we set up these monitoring feeds for them where this person who advises fund of funds can really track all the underlying holdings of those funds. So the outcome in this case was every Sunday, he would get like a newsletter, which is hyper personalized basis his portfolio or the fund's portfolio. And he would get to learn about these new insights or new news and events that was just not humanly possible for them to contract because AI can scan through thousands of documents and news articles. That insight, when he took it to his client, that, hey, I learned one of your portfolio companies is doing XYZ and it runs a risk of, something else. That interaction with his client, which is a fund, positioned him in such a great kind of a stride that, hey, this person knows our business so well that he could tell a micro insight from one of our portfolio companies among thousands of portcos. And that trust that he was able to establish with his client helped him get more business, right? So that is an example of an outcome which is so far-fetched in terms of how we think as a SaaS business at times. Usage, cohorts, how many reports are they running, frequency. But ultimately, it just translated down to that one interaction where he was able to position himself as a great advisor, and our tool enabled him to do that. So I think those are the kind of outcomes that, one doesn't really realize at times.
Nice. Thanks for sharing that anecdote because that's exactly what it needs to be all about at the end. And we often like focus so much on the use case and what do you try to achieve and to do, and like and do we solve it in as fast as possible? But like it's the fast is not important. It's the quality of it, and does that help that person or that organization to create new levels of expectations in the market that others cannot follow, which is where it all comes down. What I saw is that. You had a couple of funding rounds, but you're also getting, I mean, what I read is you're getting towards profitability or you're now profitable already. How do you go about it? I mean, so one of your things is around capital efficiency. How do you ensure that your organization can grow and meet expectations on that, on the growth level, but also stay sustainable in this incredibly fast moving world?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, right? Because right now we're in very much in the middle of the whole AI hype cycle, and we are definitely riding on that wave. There's no doubt, and it comes with certain expectations from investors, from the market. But I think it's always, we are building a business for long term, right? And irrespective of the noise and the clutter that you hear in the market of certain firms scaling to 100 million in a couple of months or things like that. One has to understand that every firm or every type of product and a firm is kind of different from each other, and the growth rates are going to be impacted by the customers that you're serving, the product that you're selling, the sales cycle that it has, right? We are serving through a direct sales model to enterprises, so obviously it's not very different from a direct to consumer or a a product-led growth kind of a model.
Exactly.
With that as a backdrop, right, even for us to think about capital efficiency, we think growth at all costs is not something that we as a firm believe in, right? We believe that if you have to create long-term value, we have to think long-term. And if you have to think long-term, then you have to take certain decisions, which again might seem counterintuitive to venture capitalist firms, but in general business sense, those are actual rational decisions. Capital efficiency for us being slightly constrained at times actually helps us in being more innovative, right? The most innovations, the most disruptive ideas actually come out of like constraints. And we don't want to give our team or even us as founders that luxury that, hey, there's enough money on the table that I can go and do a land grab. I think we need to still solve a few fundamentals.
Let me make a small interruption here. Sid just made a critical remark that sets his approach apart from most venture-backed founders. Being capital constrained actually makes you more innovative, not less. Most funded companies treat capital as fuel. More money means faster growth, means bigger teams. But Sid argues constraints force you to solve fundamentals instead of masking problems with cash. But you cannot throw money at acquisition or headcount. You have to answer the hard questions. Which customers truly matter? What actually creates value? Where should we not compete? The constraint becomes a strategy. And this is what remarkable SaaS companies do. They acknowledge they cannot please everyone. They aim to be different, not just better. And then they focus on the essence. Want to master these traits as well? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy. And inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
So I think that's where we are coming from. It's like build a long-term business. We want to be venture backed because of course it gives us the network, it gives us the credibility, it helps us, definitely add some fuel wherever we're seeing where it's okay to double down, but it's not okay to double down in all of those aspects. So I think that's really the reason why we've been slightly cautious in terms of our own firm's DNA in being cost efficient. At the
Very good.
same time, it would be amiss if I said that, hey, we do not want to grow, right? We definitely want to grow. That's what our aspirations are. But I think we just want to be slightly more level-headed about things rather than just burning some money and going bust after a couple of years.
Yeah, it's fascinating because, yeah, being a funded company, having money in the bank, but still running it as a bootstrap company. And I completely agree with you. These constraints are, yeah, I mean, they are so useful. I mean, you can always think, okay, not with all the money, we can do anything, but keep that constraint. Like, okay, what if we didn't have that money? What if we want to stay at, what is it, 20 people, 30 people, 40 people, but double the revenue? These are far more fundamental questions and far more fun to do, to answer as well.
Exactly.
You said we needed to fix, or we wanted to fix a couple of fundamentals. Can you give an example of one of the fundamentals that you say, hey, this was critical for us to fix?
Yeah, sure. Because we have a very consultative way of selling and the way in which the market is evolving, right? A lot of like new tools, a lot of like clutter, a lot of competition. You started it with like, hey, there's so many foundation models themselves kind of, making progress. So there's always a constant churn in terms of your own positioning, your own way of doing sales, right? So that's a constantly iterative kind of a process. I think we've got to a point where we have a repeatable motion where we know how to get our customers from which channels and, how to kind of convert them. But I think what I'm referring to is we want to improve our conversion rates, right? From, let's say, a sales qualified lead to a closed deal. We want to improve our conversion from, let's say, pilots to actual annual multi-year contracts. Those are still good enough for all VCs to pump in money and, kind of grow from there. But we think there's definitely much more scope for us to improve because if we take a decision right now to, push on the gas pedal and just, accelerate, even with a suboptimal conversion rate, you're just, taking it to another scale. So you want to improve certain fundamentals in terms of, hey, can I improve the sales talk tracks? Can I improve the demo process? Can I further squeeze in the sales cycle? And once we feel that we've hit that sweet spot is when would be the right time for us to press the gas pedal. That's something to do with sales. I think that's the primary, right? On the tech front, I think we definitely have a great product velocity, so very proud of the work that the team has done. And then comes the customer success or the account management part of it, right? How are we able to provide that experience? And I think, like all startups, right, we've made a bunch of mistakes in terms of where to put in our efforts, where not to put in our efforts. And I think now we feel comfortable that we've learned those lessons, we've plugged in all those gaps, and from a renewal, expansion, cross-sell, upsell perspective, we have a much better hold on things. So we feel confident that now I know that, hey, these are the teams or these are the skills or these are the roles that we need to scale for. Because otherwise, what you're doing is, you've reached, let's say, $1 million or $5 million or whatever the threshold for that funding is, but you haven't solved the problem for what is the skill gap, right? Which particular skill that do I need to get to? And mind you, the way and which you were just mentioning, right? Like, the old roles of an account executive or a customer success manager no longer apply to a post AI or a Gen AI world. Many of those roles are actually getting merged with each other. A lot of these things are, getting rationalized, if you may. And for you to know that, hey, what is the right mix of talent that you need? Do I need a solution engineer versus an account executive? Do I just need an SDR and a solution engineer and no account executive in this post AI world? Those are the kind of decisions you need to be very comfortable about before you kind of, hit that gas pedal. So I think those are things that we've been very interested to kind of follow and have those learnings.
Hours of podcast to go for this, but I have to also respect time in this case. But from the ex the experience that you've gained so far dealing with these type of decisions, if you have to give a do and a don't as an advice to other founders, CEOs of software companies that are going through the same motion, what would it be?
Sure. From a do perspective, I would say there should be a disproportionate focus on customer success right from day one. Right, the kind of learnings, like, and I think many of us tend to think of that as an afterthought, right? And I think it should not be an afterthought in a SaaS business, because for a new category that you're trying to build, and that's what is happening right now. With AI, you're infusing, you're building from services to software. That kind of a transition. For you to have a very good pulse on what the customer wants, needs, and that's constantly evolving cannot be an afterthought. So I think do customer success from day zero. I think that's a non-negotiable. From a don't perspective, what I would say is spending, overspending, or initially on marketing can sometimes distort your view. You may think that you're getting right traction because of spending something on the marketing, but that's really an artificial boost that you're kind of giving in. There is still no better traction than word of mouth or referrals from your early customers. Those first 10 early customers that you kind of gain through your own networking, through your own hustle, or whichever way you get them, even through marketing. But if you think you're going to double down on marketing and get 10 more, that's one way to do it, which I think is not the best approach. If you're not getting at least 3 to 4 referrals from your existing 10 clients, you're doing something wrong. So I think that's my other piece of advice.
Exactly. Trait number 6 in my book. Remarkable software companies create fans, not just customers. That sums it up perfectly. It's every company can create that growth, but it's about, acknowledging you cannot please everyone, delivering something that's valuable and desirable to those, and that then create fans out of those companies so that that flywheel get going. And in the meantime, you learn so much. Thank you very much for sharing all the wisdom, Sid. Where can people go to find out more about the company? Or to say hi to you.
Yeah, sure. You can reach out to www.wokelo.ai. That's Wokelo.ai. And you can also personally reach out to me. I'm Sid, SID at Wokelo.ai, in case you're interested in trying out the platform. And yeah, we're an AI agentic platform for investment research. We help consulting firms, investment banks, investors to accelerate their workflows, but also unlock unique, differentiated insights that help them generate alpha. But no, it was a pleasure, Don, for being here. Thanks so much for having me. And my wisdom is still just a couple of years, not as much as yours. And the kind of wisdom that is synthesized, articulated in your book, I think is going to be valuable to not just founders like me, but even some upcoming founders. So I would strongly recommend. But again,
Okay, thank you.
so appreciate you having me.
Thank you. I wasn't expecting a plug from your end, but always appreciate that. Let's keep in contact for the next coming years. Very eager to see what's going to happen next.
Thanks, Don. Have a good one.
And this wraps up my conversation with Sid Mason, CEO and co-founder of Wokelo. If you got value from this episode, please share it with other SaaS founders who need to hear this as well. And if you've got 10 seconds, a quick rating or review on Apple Podcasts will help more people to find these conversations. Thank you for listening to the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. If you want more insights like this, subscribe to my daily email, Espresso with Ton. It's a 2-minute shot of clarity for SaaS founders who want to create pull, not push. You can sign up, along with getting my book, at valueinspiration.com. See you in the next episode.